I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. The Zika virus was first identified in 1947 in Uganda and was seen mostly in Africa and Asia until recently. It's now spread to the Western Hemisphere and was first identified last May in Brazil, where there was an outbreak. It's been found in other Central and Latin American countries and parts of the southern United States. It's spread by a mosquito that breeds in water. Pregnant women have been told not to visit the countries where the virus is present for fear of harming their fetus. Brazil has seen an increase in the number of babies born with microcephaly in recent months. We have two guests on the show to answer all of our questions about the Zika virus, and let me introduce them to you. Peter Hotez is founding dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine and professor of pediatrics and molecular virology and microbiology at Baylor College of Medicine. And Peter Hotez, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And also with us is Jeffrey Shaman. He's Associate Professor of Environmental Health Sciences at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. He studies the environmental determinants of infectious disease transmission. And Jeffrey Shaman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
My pleasure, Marty.
Peter, let me begin with you and just begin with some of the headlines that I've been reading. We, of course, hear that the WHO has said that this virus is spreading explosively. I read a number of reports in preparation for the show. How worried, how panicked should we be?
Well, it's a great concern. And just to preface my comments, I'm not an alarmist. When Ebola hit Dallas, I went out of my way to point out why Ebola would never become entrenched in the United States or North America or the Western Hemisphere. I'm not saying that now about Zika virus. I'm quite concerned. And my concern stems from the fact, one, is its rapid spread, as you've already pointed out. There's been more than a million cases in Brazil just over the past year. Projections are 700,000 cases in Colombia, and now it's spreading rapidly through Central America, southern Mexico, and the Caribbean. Every few days, we're hearing about a new Caribbean island where Zika virus is found, such that by the end of this month, I would expect the entire Caribbean to have Zika virus. So this thing is moving at a rapid rate. And then my second concern, of course, is the dramatic consequences of maternal infection. When mothers get infected probably early in pregnancy, they're passing the virus on to their babies and causing a horrific congenital birth defect, which we'll, I guess, do a deeper dive with during this hour called microcephaly. And that's very concerning because especially in poorer areas of the Western Hemisphere where women don't have any mechanisms of protecting themselves against mosquito bites like Haiti, I think we could be seeing this extraordinary epidemic of microcephaly in places like Haiti and elsewhere.
And I will pick up on all of that. Jeffrey, let me get you in on the conversation. So this is a virus, a mosquito that was first identified about 70 years ago in Uganda. Do we know how it ended up, for instance, in Brazil or was identified in Brazil in 2015?
We don't know specifically. It's really impossible for us to track a specific virus like this. But the vector mosquitoes, all of which are of the genus Aedes, are abundant in this region already. They're invasive, and they've moved around the world with the used tire trade and trash and all the mobility that exists in the modern world. So the predominant mosquito that we're concerned about is one that's called Aedes aegypti. And that mosquito was already present. It transmits yellow fever, dengue fever, and chikungunya, which in the last few years was the mosquito-borne virus that we've been very concerned about and which has saturated much of the tropical Americas. And unfortunately, I think we're going to have to see the same thing happening with Zika because we have a functional, competent vector embedded within most of tropical America, so it's going to spread very rapidly throughout that.
Jeff, let me pick up on something you said, and I know, Peter, you want to weigh in on this as well. You talked about, Jeff, the used tire trade and its role, I guess, in the spreading of this virus. Help us understand what's the connection there.
Well, you know, the connection isn't so much to think about tires or that specific trade, but Aedes aegypti is a mosquito that likes to breed in containers. It used to do that within naturally occurring containers, but it has adapted very, very well to our modern world, and particularly urban and para-urban areas. So we tend to keep a lot of water in things like flower pots and water collection devices and pitchers, and we tend to be very lazy about it in our general surroundings where we have a lot of these containers around that are filled with water. This mosquito species exploits that. So the life cycle of mosquito includes three subadult stages, egg, larvae, and pupae, all of which are aquatic. And different mosquito species will exploit different water habitats. The Aedes aegypti mosquito exploits these artificial containers. So the flower pots around your house, water left over in little small containers and areas, it will lay its eggs in that. And in that environment, the subadults will flourish, and then they will eventually emerge as adults, and that's when they can go about their business of biting. In addition, it's a very efficient vector, because it will bite at most times of the day. It will bite in the middle of the day, it will bite at dusk, it will bite at dawn. It's actually a fairly aggressive biter of humans.
Let me go back to you, Peter. Go ahead. And I saw a photograph of you, Peter, in an article, a Texas newspaper article about the Zika virus. And you were in this photograph pointing to piles of tires, to piles of trash.
Yeah, exactly. So I would think of this as a disease of degraded urban and suburban environments. Just to give you a picture, it occurs in places where, first of all, the housing is of poor construction, dilapidated, so that mosquitoes can get in and out. Often no windows, or if they have window screens, they have holes in them, or if they have even a little bit of air conditioning, box-like air conditioners where the mosquitoes can get in and out of the sides. So that's point one. Point two is the degradation around it. So you have uncollected garbage that mosquitoes can proliferate in, discarded tires filled with water, all of the water sources that were just mentioned. So this is the picture that you see in urban cities like Recife, pronounced Recife, by the Brazilians, where you have the favelas, which are poor urban environments. It's in Salvador da Bahia. But the point is, it's not unique to those places. So you can go to almost any poor urban area of South America or Central America or the Caribbean, and there it is. And I've been making the case, and there's been some pushback about it, that some parts of the southern United States, including Houston and other Gulf Coast cities, have a hidden level of poverty with all of the same perfect storm of forces that we can find anywhere else in South America, Central America, or the Caribbean. And I believe the poor urban areas of the Gulf Coast are uniquely vulnerable to Zika for all those reasons.
I do want to talk about pregnant women, but let me pick up on something you said earlier, Peter Holtz, which is that thousands of people, or maybe a million people, have been infected. Does that mean that they are at risk, or they got bit by this bug and they felt lousy for a couple of days and now they're okay?
So the numbers are quite impressive. So over a period of a year or so, we're looking at more than a million people have been infected, mostly in Brazil and Colombia. But the World Health Organization is now projecting those numbers are over the next year are going to increase up to 4 million. So this is going to become a widespread epidemic. And what that means for the vast majority of people is that when they get bitten by a mosquito that contains the virus, they'll get virus infection and the virus will enter their bloodstream. Many of those individuals will have no symptoms at all. Mm-hmm. We're still trying to understand the percentage that will have symptoms, those which don't. Those which do have symptoms will develop typically a rash, fever, headache, pain behind the eyes, sometimes some joint symptoms, but it tends not to be a severe illness. In a small percentage of people, they seem to be going out to develop more serious neurologic disease, including Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is an autoimmune neurologic disease that could be linked to some degrees of paralysis or paresthesias, tingling of the nerves, the peripheral nervous system. But the overwhelming concern, of course, is when that virus is infecting the mother. And again, the mother can often be without symptoms at all. She could be asymptomatic. A significant percentage of those infections in the mother, the virus is going from the mother's bloodstream through the placenta into the newborn baby, where it's attacking the central nervous system and blocking the development of the brain and other aspects of the central nervous system to produce this very devastating congenital condition known as microcephaly.
You're saying there's cause and effect, that the Zika virus causes microcephaly?
That's what it's looking like, and I say that's what it's looking like rather than a simple yes, because we don't have all the I's dotted and T's crossed just yet. Here's what we know. We know that we can isolate the Zika virus from newborn babies with microcephaly in many cases. We can isolate the virus from the amniotic fluid in mothers who by ultrasound are carrying babies with microcephaly. And this was done by a group of Brazilian scientists. And then the CDC has confirmed that we can identify virus in the placenta of mothers who've had these kinds of birth outcomes. So it's we don't have everything put in place yet, but it's looking strong enough that it causes us to issue public health recommendations.
Jeff, how do you see that?
Well, I agree with much of what he says. I do think at this point it's an association, and causality is not definitively shown. There certainly could be an issue of co-infection with another pathogen that's actually leading to the more severe complications and birth defects. But I would think that a lot of the evidence is pointing to a relationship with Zika virus. The question, this of course begs the question then, well, why are we seeing this now? Why right. hadn't we seen this before in prior right. populations, which may have to do with some sort of mutation that has occurred within the Zika virus, and we could be dealing with a strain that's affecting people in a different fashion than it did previously.
But would it be, Jeff, going back to you, but I'm thinking about if this has been around and was identified about 70 years ago in Uganda, were people in Uganda or parts of Africa, did they have immunity so that they weren't dealing with the same kind of potential health problems that are here in the Americas?
Are you asking me?
I am, yes. Yes, I am. Go ahead,
You know, potentially. It's really speculation in the sense that human populations do respond to selective pressures of diseases within their environment. Now, this has been identified for 70 years, but no doubt the virus is much older than that. And we have other instances where populations locally, and a classic example would be malaria and sickle cell anemia, where populations that are in malaria zones get selected for this recessive trait that is a defense mechanism against it. It's possible something like that may have gone on over many hundreds, if not thousands, of years of Zika exposure. On the other hand, we may be able to use the tools of modern genomic analysis to actually look to see if there are variations in the strains that are being currently transmitted in the Americas. And I haven't seen anything on that as of yet, but I'm sure people are investigating that.
Peter, I'm thinking we're almost up at a break here, but I'm thinking about the people who have gotten bitten and gotten had the symptoms. Does that mean that they have some kind of immunity if they get bitten again?
Go ahead,
Peter. Yeah, about 30 seconds before our first break. Peter, go ahead.
Yeah. I think one of the – before we go any further, I think it's really important to point out that nothing about this outbreak or practically nothing is published in the scientific literature. It's all being done through World Health Organization alerts, exchanges of emails between scientists, social media. So for a lot of these questions, we're answering as best we can, connecting the dots, but we're shooting blind for a lot of it. But, you know, as far as we can tell right now, that when you get exposed to Zika, you have that short-term illness and eventually you develop antibodies and then develop some resistance. But that could still give the virus time to invade the fetus of a pregnant mother.
That's Peter Hotez, who joins us along with Jeffrey Shaman, and we are talking about the Zika virus. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. We're sure you have many questions about the Zika virus. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking about the Zika virus with Jeffrey Shaman. He's Associate Professor of Environmental Health Sciences at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. He studies the environmental determinants of infectious disease transmission. Also with us, Peter Hotez, founding dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine and professor of pediatrics and molecular virology and microbiology at Baylor College of Medicine. Also the Texas Children's Hospital Endowed Chair of Tropical Pediatrics and President of the Sabin Vaccine Institute and a Baker Institute Fellow in Disease and Poverty at Rice University. Clearly very credentialed guests to answer all your questions about what we do know or perhaps even don't know about the Zika virus. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jeff, did you want to respond or jump in on the whole part, I guess, about immunity and what happens if someone is bitten and what happens, I guess, next?
Well, I think Peter's point is actually spot on. I think that, you know, much of what is going on has not yet fully been published. If it follows along the lines of some of the other arthropod-borne viruses, such as things like chikungunya, we can expect some conferral of immunity. I don't think it's going to be like dengue, where you have multiple serotypes and issues that occur with repeated infection. But it's a disease that has not been as well studied as it should, and there the analogy with what happened with Ebola is very strong, because that was another disease that had not been very well studied at the time, and it leaves us a little bit caught by surprise and without all our understanding in place as it should be.
Jeff, is there any connection that you can point to about a connection between this Zika virus and climate change?
You know, that's a question a lot of people ask, and I think most of what you're going to get is falls in the realm of speculation about this. The majority of what I think has gone on with Zika has to do with travel and trade and the invasion of a couple mosquito species into the Americas. One is Aedes aegypti, another is Aedes albopictus, which may as well be a strong vector of the Zika virus. Both of these mosquitoes have expanded and moved around because of travel and trade, and both of them are these container breeding mosquitoes. One of them has seemed to adjust its sensitivity and is really expanding far northward. That's actually the Aedes albopictus, the one that's more speculatively associated with Zika transmission. And that one's as far as north as New York City, whereas Aedes aegypti within the United States is really mostly restricted to the southeastern United States and some areas of California. But it's saturated both of them throughout the Americas. So a really competent, strong vector that is the vector in its native regions in Africa is abundant and present already within the Americas. So what really needed was the introduction of the virus and notice of it, because it was causing more severe consequences. To get to your question of climate change or climate variability and whether El Nino is at all associated with it, there is some literature that has shown that in certain areas of the world, El Nino has been associated with outbreaks of dengue fever, which is transmitted by similar mosquitoes or the same mosquito, depending on the location. So you can actually see explosions of that, because El Nino affects local rainfall and temperature conditions and humidity levels, and those are the conditions that mosquitoes respond to. The thing that tends to be a little bit confusing about it, and I think it confuses a lot of people, is that you'll hear people say, well, in this region it got really wet and that favored an explosion of mosquitoes, and in this region it got really dry and that also favored an explosion of mosquitoes. And the truth is, you say, well, they're talking out of both sides of their mouth. How can they say both of those things? Different mosquitoes are going to respond differently, and some will be favored when the conditions are very dry, because then things get really what's called eutrophic, full of a lot of organic matter, and the water resources are much more like they like. They like dirty water. Others are going to really explode when they have an expansion of all those hydrologic resources, when there's lots of rainfall and a lot more containers or puddles and ponds, depending on the mosquito species, fill up, and there's a lot more habitat available to them. And there are indeed even some mosquitoes that may respond to both. But it's a very confused issue, and there's unfortunately has to be a lot of hand-waving about it, because we can't study it to the level of detail that we would like to actually fully understand it.
Peter Hiltus, let me go back to you, and I'm imagining people listening having many questions. What should then the public health response be, at least as we understand this Zika virus so far? And what should an individual do? I mean, is it turning over the flower pots or making sure the tires are not filled with dirty water? What should people do?
Well, there's the situation right now in the poorest regions of the Americas, where we need to undertake emergency measures. And then there's the anticipatory issues that we'll have to address in the United States. So regarding the first part, I often like to point out that between 1947 and 1962, an initiative led by the World Health Organization and its Pan-American Health Organization component, the WHO in the Western Hemisphere, actually eradicated Aedes aegypti mosquitoes for a time in 18 Latin American countries, and there were dramatically reduced rates of dengue and yellow fever as a result. And it's very instructive to look at what happened back in the 1950s to see what might apply to today in terms of emergency measures that might come out of the WHO recommendations any day now. where what was done was to embark on an aggressive program of insecticidal spraying, especially indoors and houses, and also an equally aggressive effort to get rid of any bodies of standing water, or when you couldn't actually remove the water, to put paraffin oil on the surface. So it wasn't elegant. It required a military-style campaign, but it was highly effective. And given the potentially dire consequences of having thousands upon thousands of babies born with microcephaly over the next 9 months in the new areas where the virus is invading, I think these are measures that we're going to have to take very seriously.
And some countries are saying to women of childbearing age, do not get pregnant.
Yeah, and that's a recommendation in some ways born out of desperation, because in the absence of aggressively working to control the mosquito vector, that's about all we can do at this point. We have no vaccine. All of the other methods for controlling mosquitoes, the new technologies are still mostly unproven when applied on a large scale. So that's an extraordinary recommendation. I think one of the comments that I've been making about public health advisories from ministries of health in some of the Caribbean countries and Central America not to get pregnant, I think it's one thing to say that, but I think it's important to remember that it's women who live in poverty who are the most vulnerable to Zika. And so unless you're going to provide support in terms of providing methods of contraception, providing medical advice, it's not going to be effective just to simply make that recommendation as an isolated, standalone public health advisory might have very little impact.
Let me get some callers in. We've got, it looks like Kathy from Voorhees, New Jersey, to join us in Radio Times. Kathy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
We're going to Ecuador and then on to Galapagos in another month. And we have children of childbearing age. When I come home, could I be a carrier? And also, should I immerse myself in DEET when I'm there?
All good questions, Kathy. Let me toss that to Jeffrey Shaman. Jeffrey, you want to respond to Kathy's question?
Sure. I'll start by saying that insect repellent and long sleeves are a great way to go. You need to have that kind of personal protection. It's very important. I would also just be aware of the mosquitoes and keep advised of when they're around and biting and try to avoid them there. But insect repellents with DEET, even though it's a little bit toxic to smell, are a very good way of actually engendering personal protection for yourself. In terms of the transmission when you get back to the U.S., I may differ a little bit with Peter's opinion here in that I really do think of Zika as I did for Ebola. It's a disease of poverty. And I think the developing world is struggling with it because they have not been able to keep people and mosquitoes as sequestered from one another as we do in the developed world. We have the mosquitoes here already that can transmit it, as we have for chikungunya and dengue, but we really haven't had any sustained outbreaks of these diseases. As a matter of fact, here in New York City, we have a lot of people who've come off the plane with chikungunya because a lot of people travel to the Caribbean and places where that's abundant and they come back, but we've had no recorded instances where there's been local transmission. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't be concerned and you shouldn't protect yourself from mosquito bites, but the reality is that there isn't enough contact between mosquitoes and humans to really sustain transmission of Zika or chikungunya or dengue in most regions of the United States.
Peter, do you agree with that about human-to-human transmission of Zika?
Yeah, no, I would say that through most of the United States, the likelihood we're going to see Zika outbreaks is probably small. Although I would just – but the caveat is we know so little bit about this virus that, you know, we cannot always assume that this virus will go by the same playbook as chikungunya or dengue. But I reserve that special emphasis on the U.S. Gulf Coast, where we have a level of extreme poverty that not many people are aware of. And so that I would say in some of the poorest areas of Houston, New Orleans – Mobile, Alabama, maybe moving into northern Florida. There is a real risk, I think, of that there could be more sustained transmission and therefore have to plan accordingly.
What I hear from both of you, I'm sure Kathy, she wants very specific advice here. I'm not sure you can give it to you, Peter Hotez, which is cover up, use some kind of repellent, and you'll probably be okay. Did I read that right, Peter? to Kathy's call about going to Ecuador?
Without having a vaccine, a highly effective vaccine, there's no foolproof method of avoiding getting Zika or any other arbovirus infections. But you can certainly stack the deck in your favor by using DEET and also applying DEET in an appropriate manner. So if you go to either the CDC websites or some of the other websites, you can get some very specific instructions on how to apply DEET, you know, especially if you're using in the context of other protective measures. I should mention there is transmission in Ecuador now. I'm not aware of it on the Galapagos Islands, and it really depends on how active and outdoors you're going to be.
Kathy, I appreciate the call. I have a comment from David from Flemington, Jeff, saying wonders whether there's transmission between animals and people, or perhaps even people and animals. Do we know if there is, Jeff?
There are no reservoirs outside of primates that participate in Zika transmission as far as we know. And again, maybe this is something that has been overlooked because there isn't a lot of literature on it. But most of the transmission we think going on within the human communities is being sustained by transmission between mosquitoes and humans. Primates are capable of being infected also, though. So in areas in the tropics where there are monkey populations, they may certainly be acting as a reservoir for Zika, and it may be going through their populations as well.
Does a bite, Jeff, from Zika look different from a bite from a different kind of mosquito? Is there something unique about the bite?
No, I don't think you're going to find anything unique about it. I mean, basically, the female mosquitoes feed on us to get blood to support egg development. And it's very similar. Some of them may be a little bit more painful. Some of the mosquitoes are a little bit larger. Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus are a bit large in the mosquitoes, and they have sort of characteristic striping patterns on them that make them noticeable. They also will tend to be a little bit more aggressive about biting humans and will do it in the middle of the day. So that may be the type of mosquito activity that people pay a little bit more attention to. But in terms of the characteristics of the bite, it's not particularly painful or unusual compared to other mosquito species.
And that's Jeffrey Shaman joining us along with Peter Hotez, and we are talking about the Zika virus, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. A lot of comments coming in as well. Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Peter Hotez, going back to you, and you mentioned the word vaccine. Is that, if I guess looking ahead, is that an option? Is that something that should be investigated and put on the fast track to deal with this spreading issue?
Certainly. If as fast as you can fast track vaccines. One of the things that we do at our Sabin Vaccine Institute in Texas Children's Hospital is we make neglected tropical disease vaccines. Vaccine development, unfortunately, is not like small molecule drug manufacturing. It's what we say the black art of pharmaceuticals. It can take a long time, sometimes up to years, to make a safe and effective vaccine. And one of the factors that's going to slow down vaccine development for Zika even more is that if the target product profile of the vaccine is for women of reproductive age who are pregnant or thinking of becoming pregnant, that it raises the bar even higher in terms of the safety profile for the vaccine. So unfortunately, I do not think we're going to have a vaccine in time for this Zika outbreak, but it still means we still need to advance efforts because Zika could potentially spread in other places of the world where Aedes mosquitoes exist.
Let me get Jose from Wayne to join our conversation. Jose, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi, good
hi
morning. Thanks
good
for
morning.
The program.
Sure.
The doctor mentioned several of the mosquitoes. Here in Wayne, we have what I believe is the Asian tiger mosquito. I'm familiar with it from Virginia, where I used to live there in Falls Church. It actually, I think it likes the gutters and whatnot, but it bites during the day. And I was wondering if that mosquito is a good carrier for the same types of diseases that we're talking about.
Jeff, can you answer that?
Sure. The Asian tiger mosquito is the one I refer to as Aedes albopictus. That's its genus and species name. And it is a putative, supposed vector of Zika, potentially. It hasn't been shown as much as Aedes aegypti, but we're seeing that it's thought that it may very well. It actually occupies a very similar ecological niche as Aedes aegypti, the one that's doing the transmission to humans in most of the tropics. And it also, like Aedes aegypti, is a known transmitter for chikungunya and dengue and yellow fever. So that mosquito is present in the Northeast. It's present in the Philadelphia area. It's been here for over a decade, and it is an invasive species. So the reality is there's a vector here that is most likely capable of transmitting Zika virus. But again, I'm going to stress the reality is in most areas in the United States, there is not enough contact between people and these mosquitoes to sustain transmission locally.
Peter, do you agree with that?
Well, I think if what we don't know is what's the preferred vector for transmitting Zika. Clearly, Aedes aegypti is going to be an important one. There are reports from Gabon of Aedes albopictus also transmitting this virus. If it turns out Aedes albopictus is an efficient transmitter of Zika, then I think we're in for a long, hard ride potentially in 2016 because Aedes albopictus, the Asian tiger mosquito, is all the way up into the mid-Atlantic states and has a much wider geographic range. Aedes aegypti is more confined to the Gulf Coast and a few places in California and Tucson. So that's something that we're going to have to really follow, especially as we move into the warmer spring and summer months, if we start seeing Zika transmission here.
And we're almost up in a break here, Peter, but does winter kill off a lot of these mosquitoes?
Well, for instance, in Harris County, which is where Houston is, we have a very active mosquito control division, and they're trapping mosquitoes on a weekly basis. We are seeing Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus mosquitoes in small numbers, Culex mosquitoes in larger numbers, but they're starting to creep up. So as you get into the warmer months, you start seeing a lot more mosquito activity.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about the Zika virus. And the WHO is apparently going to make an announcement today about how to, I guess, slow the transmission and how to deal with this virus. And we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking about the Zika virus with Jeffrey Shaman, Associate Professor of Environmental Health Sciences at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University, and Peter Hotez, Founding Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine and Professor of Pediatrics and Molecular Virology and Microbiology at Baylor College of Medicine. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Bunch of emails, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jeff, if I can go back to you, I was reading about creating or using genetically modified mosquitoes as a way to deal with the Zika virus. Can you talk a bit about that? I guess perhaps the pros and the cons?
Sure. So there are a number of more inventive strategies that have been studied for a number of decades, actually, that are trying to provide different ways of controlling mosquito populations that would be different from the way Aedes aegypti was eradicated in much of South America in the 50s and 60s. So instead of actually asking people to turn over their flower pots and spraying insecticides and larvicides, they've been looking for alternate ways of controlling mosquito populations. One of them has been to create sort of what have been referred to sometimes as super mosquitoes, mosquitoes that are bred in the laboratory that are highly fecund but somehow refractory to the virus. So they're not as efficient at transmitting it, and the idea would be to then release those mosquitoes and have them outcompete the existing wild type, the native mosquitoes that are out there, and take over so that you would have a mosquito species that's less efficient as a vector. That's more targeted towards malaria, typically. But there are two strategies that have been developed that have been much more targeted towards the Aedes aegypti mosquitoes that's transmitting Zika. One has to do with sterile male release, which is that you breed a mosquito in the laboratory that you sustain with an antibiotic, which if that antibiotic is removed, it produces offspring that don't survive through adulthood. And the idea is that you breed a lot of those, and then you release them into the population, these males. The antibiotic is no longer being given to them. They breed with females, and their offspring just don't survive.
Yeah.
It's been tested on some islands, and it actually can greatly reduce local mosquito populations. So that's sterile male release. Another is the Wolbachia bacterium, which is this bacterium that doesn't natively affect Aedes aegypti, but does affect other insects. And they've infected it in the lab in the mosquitoes. And what it does is it makes them less efficient at actually themselves being infected by this virus.
Hmm.
So the virus doesn't replicate as well. And the thought is that if you can introduce those mosquitoes into the population and they start breeding it, and then the bacterium may actually be passed from mother to progeny, mother to egg, then you might actually get this bacterial infection throughout the population, and that will actually then reduce its efficiency as a vector of the disease. Now, I think it's important to realize that, you know, some of these are sound very sexy, but none of them is by itself a panacea for controlling these types of diseases. If anything, the history of infectious diseases taught us is that we have to have multiple strategies for trying to eradicate diseases, and we have to use those multiple strategies simultaneously. We can't simply just apply insecticides. We have to vary the insecticides. We have to control water habitats. We have to tell people to have protective measures and keep them warned. So these strategies may be useful and they may be worth investing in, but we have to think about how we want to prioritize this as we're going at it and not put too much stock in any one strategy going forward.
Peter Hotez,
I would agree with that. You know, there's a lot of chatter, especially in social media, about all the new technologies, and I think they're very interesting and very exciting. It's not clear whether these are going to be available to apply on a large scale in time for this outbreak. So I think what we're looking at are traditional methods of mosquito control using insecticides and resource reduction with water. But we can also look at some of these other new technologies and pilot studies, and if they're looking very promising, then expand them. But I wouldn't put all of the emphasis right now on the new technologies.
Speaking of social media, Peter, I have a tweet from someone who wants to know, is there a connection between Guillain-Barré syndrome and Zika? Peter?
Well, thanks for that question. Well, it's a great question, and there's nothing published about it. But we're relying on the New York Times and the Washington Post as our source of information.
Yeah.
it's in some PAHO WHO alert. So it's looking like there is an association, but we've not seen anything published. So there's been an uptick in the number of Guillain-Barré cases in Brazil as well as El Salvador. And we've seen this with other virus infections. Guillain-Barré is what happens is you make an immune response to the virus infection, and that antibody and cellular response has the ability to cause what's called demyelination of some of the peripheral nerves. So it's certainly possible, and I wouldn't discount it. But again, I don't think it's an overwhelming problem relative to the issue of maternal infection and microcephaly.
Jeff, I'm looking at another headline, as it turns out, from the New York Times from last week. Zika virus, two cases suggest it could be spread through sex. Can you respond to that, Jeff?
I think it falls into this sort of popular gray literature that there is some evidence for it. So the one that I'm aware of, there was, I believe, a medical entomologist or a mosquito researcher who was aware he had gotten Zika and believes that he transmitted to his spouse through sex. The issue really is whether or not you're going to get sustained transmission with something like this frequently enough that it's going to become a sexually transmitted disease. It's sort of analogous to people's being concerned with Ebola. Is it going to become airborne, for instance? And the evidence doesn't show that you're going to get a lot of transmission that way. Actually, also with Ebola, the possibility of sexual transmission. I think one instance of it is interesting. It's important to monitor and to look at. But right now, what we really need to focus on is mosquito-borne transmission, because that's where it's really all happening virtually. And we need to look at this in the developing world, because this is a disease of impoverished areas. It really is. That's where the focus has to be.
Let me get Mike. Yeah, go ahead, Peter, and then we'll get Michael on.
And I can't emphasize enough the time urgency, because we can't stand around and wait 9 months for babies to show up with microcephaly in obstetrical wards and labor and delivery suites. And so this is the situation we're faced right now. We've already, in some ways, missed our opportunity in Brazil. Mm. Maybe we're missing our opportunity in Colombia. But now as it moves into Central America and southern Mexico and the Caribbean, here's where I believe we have to wage war against Aedes mosquitoes and be very aggressive in controlling. So I don't know if the emergency, if WHO will issue the public health emergency of international concern, as they call it, today or tomorrow. But I think if and when it does happen, it has to be immediately followed by aggressive action to stop this in the Caribbean and other affected areas. Haiti, for instance, is going to get decimated unless we do something.
What do you mean by decimated?
So Haiti has a birth cohort of 250,000 newborn babies every year. These are 250,000 mothers who, for all practical purposes, have no protection against Aedes mosquitoes. So depending on we could be looking at maybe half of these mothers being infected with the Zika virus over the next few months. And we don't know the percentage of vertical transmission from mother to baby, but we could be looking at tens of thousands of cases of microcephaly in a country that essentially has a broken health system or a devastated health system. And on top of everything else Haiti's experiencing, this we're looking at potentially a humanitarian catastrophe because of Zika virus.
Oh, dear. Let me get Michael from, looks like Hatboro, to join us on Radio Times. Michael, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
I have a question. I was curious to know, what would happen if an infant or newborn contracted or was infected with the Zika virus after they were born?
Have you looked at that, Jeff?
I haven't looked at that, and I'm not aware of literature documenting specifically what happens with neonatals. Peter, are you aware of this at all?
Yeah, I was going to say. Peter?
Well, I mean, microcephaly happens due to an insult early on when the baby's in the mother's womb. So we're probably looking at first and second trimester. And actually, the irony is we can take our lessons learned from the last time we've had a catastrophic outbreak of a virus that causes microcephaly, and it happened in Philadelphia in the early 1960s, where 1% of pregnancies were associated with congenital rubella syndrome. It happened in the pre-vaccine era, and it was associated with first and early second trimester rubella infection. And it was only after the Wistar Institute and embarked on an ambitious effort to make a rubella vaccine, these were efforts led by Stan Plotkin and others, that we actually were able to curtail the problem of congenital rubella syndrome. So really points to the power of a vaccine. But it looks as though it's a viral infection early in pregnancy.
Michael, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Talking about the Zika virus today on Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get back to some of the comments here from Christy from Fishtown. She traveled to Brazil 6 months ago, wonders if Zika can sit dormant in her body and could hurt a baby during a future pregnancy. Jeff, can I toss that back to you?
You know, again, I, as someone who's not a virologist, I would think Peter could probably answer this better than I can, actually. Peter?
Yeah, Peter, go ahead.
Well, I'm hoping it's not the case. Most of these arbovirus infections are short-lived, and then you develop an immune response, and then you control the virus. There are some exceptions. So, for instance, West Nile virus, one of our faculty at the National School of Tropical Medicine, has shown that West Nile in some individuals seems to be able to persist in the kidneys and maybe even the central nervous system to cause long-standing infections. It doesn't appear to be the case with Zika, but again, this we've never studied the virus affecting this many people. So there may be things that are happening when you see large populations affected that we don't see otherwise. So it's fingers crossed. Hopefully the answer is no, but we'll have to see as this epidemic unfolds.
Looking ahead, and Jeff, and I'm thinking about Ebola. I mean, each virus, I think, is unique unto itself. But nonetheless, you know, as I guess the public, it often feels like we are fighting the last war. Is there a way to use this Zika virus and its history to be a little bit more proactive, looking ahead to, if not this virus, perhaps another virus from a different mosquito that might be in the future sometime?
That's a great question, and that's sort of an issue that we're constantly grappling with in public health. You know, we sit here and we often use tools that are advantageous against the previous outbreak and try to fit them to actually combating what our latest epidemic is. And you see this in a lot of instances in a lot of disaster responses. I was just recently talking to a colleague who was talking about the response, strange analogy, to the oil spill in the Gulf, and how for the first month what they were doing is they had essentially taken the rule book off that they had developed for how to respond to an oil spill from the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska. And it was about a month before they realized that it was completely not analogous at all. Mm-hmm. We have that difficulty when we're dealing with these outbreaks and these emergence of pathogens that we really hadn't been focusing on or weren't even aware of. We've had a list of them over the last few years. We've had chikungunya, we've had Zika, we've had MERS, we've had SARS, we've had pandemic flu strains, and we've had Ebola. And they keep cropping up and emerging, and one of the central difficulties is how do you predict that initial emergence? It's a bit of a needle in the haystack, but what it really requires is it requires greater surveillance. It requires better monitoring. And again, this is an issue in the developing world that's incredibly hamstrung by limited resources. It's something that a lot of non-government organizations and foundations are trying to invest monies in order to improve surveillance of infectious diseases in those areas. And there's a lot of research going out there just to characterize and catalog the abundance of viruses that are out there, both in humans, in domestic animals, and in wildlife. So it's that kind of surveillance that's going to give us some level of knowledge and understanding of what's going on. But the problem is these systems are really protean. They're shifting all the time. They're constantly responding to selective pressure and evolving. And new strains potentially emerge of what were considered old viruses that are doing things that we hadn't seen before and hadn't anticipated. Zika virus is a telling example. We had not seen it associated with this level of birth defects before. You know, similarly with Ebola, we had not seen it penetrate into urban environments before, and there was real concern that we were going to have an endemic situation, and it still hasn't fully been stamped out. So we're going to be seeing this a lot, and the only thing I can offer is that we have to be vigilant, we have to invest in the surveillance so that we can get on top of these immediately, and then there has to be, as Peter said, a willingness to marshal resources to nip these in the bud and to actually go out there and do what it takes to eliminate them. In this case, we have to go for old-time mosquito control right now in the areas that are going to be affected.
And Peter, we're almost out of time, and I know you want to say something. I'm thinking about making sure screens are in windows, putting on repellents, spray, turning over those pots that are whatever that have standing water, all things that people should be doing?
Yeah, absolutely. And just to follow up with Jeff's comments, I think the world has not really realized that we have to invest more in health. I often point out that the entire budget of the World Health Organization is less than half the budget of the Centers for Disease Control and one-tenth of the budget of the NIH. So we haven't invested in, and yet we're only now realizing that these diseases not only have enormous health implications, but enormous economic implications, and these diseases are a global security issue. So the global health security agenda launched by the White House is advancing some of those surveillance efforts, but we need also investment in new technologies, which is just not happening on a global scale either.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times, giving us a bit of a reality check on this Zika virus. Peter Hotez, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Founding Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine, also Professor of Pediatrics and Molecular Virology and Microbiology at Baylor College of Medicine. Jeffrey Shaman, thank you very much as well.
My pleasure, Marty.
And he's Associate Professor of Environmental Health Sciences at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. We appreciate all those comments and the calls as well. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about the program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.